something a little bit different this morning than usual. It does relate to our series that we're in the middle of on Pirkei Avos. Just to remind those who are here, we are learning Pirkei Avos this year. We are still in Perek Aleph. We are up to Mishnah Gimel. And as I was looking into the importance of this Mishnah and the history behind the Mishnah, I was struck by something that really brought me straight into the story of Hanukkah. So the Mishnah that we're up to is Antignos Ishsocho Kibel Mishimon HaTzadik. Antignos, who was the student of Shimon HaTzadik, we spoke in the past few weeks about Shimon HaTzadik and who he was and how significant his leadership was for the Jewish people. He had a student by the name of Antignos who taught us, Hu Haya Omer, Al Tiyu Ka'avadim HaMeshamshim Esarav Amanas L'Kabal Pras. Our perspective in life should not be that we only serve God because we know that we will get reward and we know that He's going to repay us in kind. But rather, Elu Havu Ka'avadim HaMeshamshim Esarav Shalo Amanas L'Kabal Pras. We should always feel that it's worthwhile to serve God with or without the reward. That is the lesson of Antignos. That is what we were supposed to learn this morning. And I was looking into this Mishnah, and it's an extremely important historical entry about what happened as a result of this teaching of Antignos Ishsocho. We'll get to that next week. But what I really got into was, as a result, was the Hanukkah story. This happened pretty close to the time of the Hanukkah miracle. And as we know, we're coming up to the holiday of Hanukkah, and it's an opportunity for us to think about what happened on Hanukkah and what exactly we celebrate. So we look at the tefillah that we insert on Hanukkah. And you'll see next week when we finish off the story about our Mishnah here, you'll understand why all of it comes together. But for now, we say in our davening, Ala Nisim v'Ala Purkan, we thank the Ribono Shel Olam for the incredible, overwhelming miracles that He gave us in the days of Hanukkah. And in the midst of that context, of that paragraph, we say, Masarta Giborim B'Yad Chalashim, you put the mighty in the hands of those who are weak, V'Rabim B'Yad Me'atim, U'tmeim B'Yad Tehorim, U'rishayim B'Yad Tzadikim, V'Zeidim B'Yad Oskei Sarasecha. What exactly are we referring to when we say this whole description of how everything unfolded, what exactly took place, and how do we fully appreciate and understand what was going on? And that's what I'd like to focus on today. It's going to be just a history lesson because I think it's important for us to understand what it is that we celebrate on Hanukkah, and it will be a perfect lead-in to our study of the Mishnah next week that we are currently up to in Mishnah Gimel in Pirkei Avos. So we begin that this whole story really is a description of the Bayis Sheni. The Jewish people had a first Beis Hamikdash. Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. They all were sent into exile. They go down to Bavel. They stay there for 70 years. The Navi told them from the outset, we're only going to be here 70 years. After that, you have a right to return. Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi tried to convince the entire community that it's time to go back on Aliyah. It's time to come back and be involved in Shivas Tzion. Very few Jews heed the call. Very few Jews are interested in returning. But they go ahead with the plan anyway. And this Shivas Tzion movement, although it was not so successful, this movement is what precipitated the rebuilding of the second Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara tells us, the historians seem to have a different account, but the Gemara tells us that the second Beis HaMikdash lasted for 420 years. And you would say, what a beautiful Beis HaMikdash, 420 years, sounds wonderful. And in those 420 years, closer to the end of the period of the Bayis Sheni, there was a king by the name of Herod. The Gemara refers to him as Hurdus. And Herod decided that he should do a whole makeover of the Beis HaMikdash. And he upgraded all of the infrastructure and all of the architecture of the Beis HaMikdash. He made it so beautiful that the Gemara says in the beginning of Maseches Baba Basra, Mishalo Ra Binyan Hurdus, anyone who never experienced that incredible building that Herod was responsible for building, which was the Beis HaMikdash, Lo Ra Binyan Na'e Miyamav, never has seen a beautiful architectural building in his life. So much so that the Gemara says Herod wanted to also coat the entire Beis HaMikdash in gold because he felt that's the way a palace should be built, especially if it's God's palace. And for whatever reason, the Chachamim said, let's stop, let's leave it where it is. But basically, it gives you a picture of what the glorious feeling of the second Beis HaMikdash was. Sounds wonderful, but what's important to have in the context of the second Beis HaMikdash and understanding it is that it was not a glorious period at all for the Jewish people. The period of the second Beis HaMikdash went through terrible calamity, went through terribly tumultuous times, as we'll see next week, and why it directly relates to our Mishnah that we're up to. But even just the Chanukah story that happened before our Mishnah, around 100 years before, or within 100 years, that was something that was not a simple story at all. And everything that led up to it was extremely complicated and made life very, very difficult. So let's begin the story as follows. The Jews come back on this movement of Shivas Tzion, and at the time they were under the rulership of the Persian government, the Persian Empire. They were the ones who encouraged the Jews and gave them the right to come back to Eretz Yisrael. After not long, after the Persians had given that permission, not long afterward, Alexander the Great, who was a Greek, we spoke about him a few weeks ago as well, Alexander the Great, who was one of the Greek leaders, took over this Persian rulership, and the Persians were just gone. That was the end of them. And now Alexander the Great, for anyone who knows a little bit about the history, Alexander the Great became by far the most powerful and conquering emperor in the world. And he was so into his leadership, he decided there was no community in the world that he wanted to leave untouched, and he wanted to conquer everything that he could. And he became an extremely important figure in that generation, in that era. Alexander the Great then at some point died. But before he died, it was a very unfortunate death that he had. Alexander the Great actually died because one of his ministers, one of his closest advisors, was pretty jealous of the fact that his king, that Alexander the Great, was becoming so popular and so powerful, and he ultimately killed him. One of his closest advisors went and killed Alexander the Great. But Alexander, as he saw that his end was coming closer and closer, Alexander the Great decided that he was going to do something to make sure the world would never forget about him. How does one make sure that the world always remembers me as the greatest, most powerful conqueror of the world, the most important emperor that the world ever had? Maybe someone's going to come after me and do the same thing. How do I ensure that that is not going to happen? How do I make sure that future generations will always remember the great leadership that I had? So Alexander the Great decided the best way to do that is, if you take away the leadership from one person and you now divide it amongst many, there's no way that one person can ever rise to power, because they're always going to have someone else that's going to be in charge of a different area and a different location. So what he decided to do was to be cholek malchuso liyud beis chalakim. Alexander the Great decided that he was going to split up his rulership, his monarchy, into 12 different sections, and each one of those ministers had a responsibility toward that particular area, and that was his idea. Sounds like a great idea, and this way everyone will remember the last great person that we had, who was the emperor of the world, was Alexander the Great. After him, everything splintered apart, and nobody was able to have that kind of leadership any longer. So it was a nice idea. The problem was it didn't work out at all. And there were all kinds of political wars and civil wars, and each one of these 12 ministers were trying to outdo each other, and it just didn't work out at all. And in the end, the way it turned out was that the Greek leadership was now boiled down to four different communities, four different leaders. One of those was Talmai. Talmai was the one who had the opportunity to be in charge of Mitzrayim. He was in charge of Egypt. And he was also given the leadership of Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael. So Talmai is the one who now becomes relevant, and he now comes onto the scene that's important for the Jewish community, who had come back and made Aliyah and rebuilt a Beis HaMikdash. Until this point, they had a wonderful relationship with the government. As we said, the Persian government allowed them to come. Persian government allowed them, facilitated the building of the second Beis HaMikdash. Alexander the Great had a wonderful relationship with the Jewish community as well. We said a few weeks ago that he wanted to destroy them at some point, and he saw Shimon HaTzadik, and he was so overwhelmed by his presence, and he decided to allow Yerushalayim to be safe and to stay the way it was. So they had a pretty positive relationship. Everybody was okay. There was equality. They had rights. They had religious freedoms. But then comes along this Talmai, who is now the new leader after Alexander the Great created this breakdown after he died. And now he comes with a very different attitude and a completely different approach toward what he would do with the Jews in Yerushalayim. Now, they were totally caught off guard because the Jews in Yerushalayim did not have any precedent of oppression in the last couple of years, and they thought everything was fine. Now they have this new leader, they assumed it was the same. Talmai comes up to Yerushalayim, he says he's coming to offer a carbon in the Beis HaMikdash, he says he wants to check out what's doing there, and the truth is he came to Yerushalayim and decided to start persecuting the Jews, And very unexpectedly, he shows up there. He takes 120,000 people, 120,000 Jews captive. He takes many of them to be members of his army. He takes a whole lot of them and he sells them out to be slaves to all different parts of the world. He then goes and breaks the walls of Yerushalayim. And not only that, he now raises the taxes for any Jews that were left behind and he spared their lives. He raised the taxes to make life pretty much impossible for the Jews who remained in Yerushalayim afterward. That is what happened. At the same time that that massacre, that terrible breakdown was going on physically, there was also a terrible deterioration of Jewish spiritual life in Yerushalayim as well. And many of the Jews had moved down, they made Yeridah. Many of the Jews now decided to leave. If Talmai was this powerful king who has all kinds of demands on us, why don't we go and open a community down in his town, which is in Egypt? And many of the Jews left Yerushalayim, left Eretz Yisrael, and created this incredible community in Alexandria Shel Mitzrayim. The Gemara has descriptions of the shul in Alexander. The Gemara says there that Alexandria Shel Mitzrayim, which was named after Alexander the Great, because he conquered it. So the Gemara tells us that Alexandria Shel Mitzrayim had a shul which was so big with so many people who used to come that nobody was even able to hear the chazan, not because people were talking, but because it was just too big. They couldn't hear. And it said they used to wave a flag every time they were at the end of a bracha in Shmona Esrei. People should know to answer Amen. There was just no way of knowing what was going on. That's how big the shul was. That gives us a little bit of a picture of how many people were flocking out of Yerushalayim, going down to rebuild their communities out in Mitzrayim, because they thought, this is the end, this is it. We came back, we had a short-lived life here in Yerushalayim, we had a Beis HaMikdash, but now it's all over. And that really was the beginning of this terrible decline, of this downward spiral of the Jewish community, and many, many Jews decided to have a thriving life and community outside of Yerushalayim. But there were many who stayed behind, and who were trying to uphold everything that Yerushalayim was all about. And as we said before, there was a tremendous towering figure of that generation by the name of Shimon HaTzadik. We spoke about him last week, 2 weeks ago. Shimon HaTzadik was the one who really held everything together. And he was the last one who was able to hold the Avodah and the Beis HaMikdash to the standard that it was supposed to be done. And we spoke about how valiantly he fought to have things done the way they were properly supposed to be done, and how after he passed away, things also just degenerated. Everything fell apart. How so? So the Gemara says the following story. The Gemara Menachas Daf Kuf Tes tells us that Shimon HaTzadik, who was this amazing personality, had two children. One was the name Shimi, and one was the name Chanyo. I didn't check again this morning which one was older, which one was younger. It's not really relevant which one it was, but there were two children, Shimi and Chanyo. Now the Gemara says one of them was 2.5 years older than the other. And the truth is, the Gemara tells us that Shimon HaTzadik, when he saw he was no longer able to serve as the Kohen Gadol, Shimon HaTzadik saw that his younger son, who was 2.5 years younger, was the one who really was fit for the job. He was the one who was more learned, he was the one who really knew how to be a charismatic leader. It just fit him far better than it fit the older child. And Shimon HaTzadik designated his younger son to take over after him, and he asked that he lead the charge in the Beis HaMikdash, that he be the Kohen Gadol. And that was the plan. The younger son was such a nice, kind gentleman. He said, it's not really respectful of me to take this position over my brother. I have an older brother who's also a wonderful Jew. He might not be as talented as I am, but he's a wonderful person, and therefore he should be the one to take the position first. And whenever he feels that he's not able to do it any longer, then I'll take his position. But for now, he decided to give it to his brother. Sounds wonderful. The problem is, after a very short period of time, he regretted his decision. And although his older brother took the job and was very happy to have the job, the younger brother was now jealous and resentful of the fact that his brother had this incredibly powerful position in the Jewish community, and he decided that he was going to do whatever he can to get it back. Now, how do you get it back after this is already in motion and after the brother is already serving as the Kohen Gadol? How do you get it back? So he has all kinds of ideas. He comes up with an idea that he was going to trick his brother, and he goes and he fools him, he misled him, and he told him the way you're supposed to serve the Avodah on Yom Kippur in the Beis HaMikdash is X and Y, and he purposely told him a lie. He purposely told him something that he knew would just trip him up and he knew would anger the community, and that's what happened. The Kohen Gadol goes to do the service in the Beis HaMikdash, he does the wrong thing, and the Gemara says, Bikshu Echav HaKohanim Lahargo. The Gemara says that the Kohanim were so enraged by what he had done, they wanted to kill him. They said, how dare you defile the avodah and the Beis HaMikdash, how dare you do the service this way, you know this is not the way it's supposed to be done. And he's screaming and yelling, no, it was my brother, he tricked me, I didn't want to do this. And a whole big fight breaks out, and things are really getting out of control, which is so sad that these were the two children of the undisputed leader of the generation, who was such a great, righteous, pious person, and his two children just couldn't figure out how to put it all together, and the Beis HaMikdash starts getting completely, completely out of control. Now, just to understand why this was such a coveted position, we're living at a time, you have to put yourself back into this situation, we're living at a time when there was no longer a Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin were the group of rabbis who used to adjudicate all kinds of Jewish law. They were the ones who had the final word. At this point, there was no longer a Sanhedrin. At this point as well, there was no longer anyone else who was the leader. There was no melech. There was no king anymore. We were under the leadership of others. So the leader who was the liaison between the Jewish community and all the secular forces outside was the Kohen Gadol. So not only did he lead the Beis HaMikdash, not only did he decide everything that had to be decided on behalf of the Jewish people, but he also was the one who used to negotiate with the other communities. He was the one who served as the representative of the Jewish community for all of their needs and for all the things that had to be taken care of. Now, we have this child of Shimon HaTzadik who is serving as the Kohen Gadol. His brother is trying to take it away from him. Doesn't seem to be working as of yet. He does all kinds of tricks to get him out of the position, but it's not working. Traditionally, until that point, what had happened was every time taxes needed to be collected to the secular authorities, the Kohen Gadol decided to take from a communal fund, and he would just give the money on his own to the collector, the tax collector, and he would just take care of it. This time, with this new leadership, the tax collector comes around, he wants the money, and the Kohen Gadol, under the new management, says, I'm not going to give you the money from my own money, I'm not going to give you from communal funds, you can start knocking door to door, you can figure out how to get the money. And that also led to a major concern by the authorities, because they felt, what are the Jews now rejecting us? They don't believe that they owe the taxes, they don't have to pay. So that already made the relationship a little bit more strained, and it made things a little bit more problematic. As all of this was going on, the younger brother, who wanted to be the Kohen Gadol, decides, I got to come up with a new plan. How am I going to get myself this position of Kohen Gadol? He decides he's going to go and collaborate together with Antiochus HaRasha, who was at that time the leader of Yavan. He was the one who was leading the charge against the Jewish people. Antiochus HaRasha now comes into power, and this younger brother, who so much coveted this position of the Kohen Gadol, decides, I'm going to go and negotiate with Antiochus himself. Maybe I'll pay him off, and if I bribe him enough, he'll figure out how to get me into the position. And that's what happened. This brother of his, who really wanted the position, as we mentioned, was one of the leaders of the Misyavnim. Right, so the Yavanim were the Greeks. The Misyavnim were the Jews who decided to adopt the ideology and the manifesto of these Greeks. And he was one of the leaders of that group. Can you imagine? The son of the Gadol Hador, who should have been the Kohen Gadol in the first place, who was the most suited for the job, but because of his jealousy, because of his resentment for his brother, who he ended up giving it to, look how far off he goes. And the Midrashim tell us that he was one of the first people that changed his name. He didn't want to be known by his Jewish name anymore. He now goes ahead and adopts a name which was a Greek name. And he is one of the leaders of the charge of this group of Jews who are now known as the Misyavnim. He gets involved, he starts colluding with Antiochus HaRasha, and he wants to do whatever he can to bring down, to topple the leadership of the Beis HaMikdash, all just in order that he should be able to be the one to run it. Doesn't matter at what cost. Doesn't matter how much damage he causes. He wants that his brother should not be in charge, and he wants to destroy everything. So, not only that, this young man also decided that he was going to work along with Antiochus HaRasha, and he was going to now infuse into Yerushalayim all of the philosophy and all of the ideology of the Greek religion, and that is of the Yavanim. And that is basically what happened. He now builds all kinds of, the Midrashim say, he builds all kinds of gymnasiums, he builds all kinds of schools, and he wants that the Jews in Yerushalayim should now be secular, they should have a municipality like every other government and every other country, and they shouldn't have the leadership given over to the great Kohen Gadol, or to the Talmud Chacham, or to the Sanhedrin, or to the Nasi. None of this. We want to have leadership like everybody else has. And we don't want to have that the Jews, the religious Jews, should be the ones to run Yerushalayim. And the power corrupted. And after he starts gaining some of his power, you see that the Misyavnim now go further and further away from all Torah values that they knew to be true until that point. And they completely discarded everything that they were raised with. They abandoned the religion entirely, so much so that we're told the Misyavdim decided at one point that it was no longer worthy of them to give a bris milah to their children. Bris milah is a mitzvah that Jews have been moser nefesh for so many centuries and so many generations, but they felt we want to have nothing to do with the Jewish religion, we don't identify with it, and we are no longer going to give our children a bris milah. As all of this was going on, Antiochus decided himself that he wanted to expand his own leadership. And although he was a powerful king, as we said before, there were a number of factions of the Greek government of the time, he decided it's time for him to overtake one of the other leaders, and that's what he does. He goes out on an all-out war to over-conquer Mitzrayim, and he wants to now be the leader of Egypt as well. And he galvanizes all of his troops, and he successfully now is able to rule over Egypt as well. After he felt so proud of his defeat, not of his defeat, of his conquering, thank you. So he decides that it's not good enough just to be a leader, and he makes a pesel b'demus tavniso. He makes a big idol, all just for his own hubris, all just for his own arrogance. He makes a big idol that had his own image on it, and he now lays down a new edict, a new decree, and that is, everybody who lives under my leadership, wherever you might be, has an obligation to bow down to this idol. So this now poses a new problem for the Jews living in Yerushalayim. Not only was Antiochus starting to get involved in the happenings in Yerushalayim, but now he was saying that any person, Jew and non-Jew alike, has an obligation to bow down to this idol that he created. So there were a constituency of Jews who felt they had no choice, and that's what they did. There were other Jews who felt that this was so antithetical to everything they stood for, and it was something they absolutely could not give into. And the Jews, the Misyavnim, who had given into all of this ideology, had used this as an opportunity to slander and malign the Jewish community who was still trying to hold on to the faith. And in spite of the religious community, they went and they told Antiochus that they're rebelling against you, they don't bow down to your idol, and all kinds of horrible things are going on there. And now Antiochus decides, you know, it's time for me to come to Yerushalayim and see what's going on myself. He comes to Yerushalayim, and he decides he wants to take revenge against the Jews who are still living in Yerushalayim, who hadn't been killed before. When he gets there, what was the saddest part of it all is that the Misyavnim, as we know, Yerushalayim is a very mountainous terrain. And it's not so easy to navigate your way around Yerushalayim unless you know exactly how to get there. Not only that, there were walls that were surrounding Yerushalayim. Some of them were broken, but many of them were very strong, powerful walls. And the Misyavnim basically colluded with this leadership of Antiochus and led them straight into Yerushalayim, showed them around the whole community, showed them exactly how to take it over, gave them all the secrets of war, and basically that was the end of the Jewish community. We're told in the Medrash that there were thousands and thousands, 40,000 Jews or something, that were killed on that occasion. Antiochus went ahead and massacred. And I think sometimes when we think about the story of Hanukkah, it is not displayed in the proper perspective. Sometimes we say that Purim was about a physical war and Hanukkah was about a spiritual war. It's not entirely true. That's part of the story. Yes, there were many who became Misyavnim. There were many Jews in the times of Hanukkah who decided to become a part of that whole ideology, but there were thousands and thousands of Jews leading up to that story who also were killed along the way, and there were horrible massacres going on. Like this story in Yerushalayim, where thousands of Jews were killed, and at that time, the Jews who remained in Yerushalayim realized that it was going to be an impossible scenario for them to ever stay there in the long term, and they went to hide in the forest. One of those families who went to hide in the forest was Matisyahu Ubanov. Was the great Matisyahu. Is it all coming? Is this interesting to anybody? I don't know. It was interesting to me. So I have to tell you, I read about 400 pages this week to put this all together. This is the summary. I am in no way a historian. I'm just trying to give the highlights of the story. Okay, so one of those families that ran away was Matisyahu Ubanov. And that was a very prestigious family who were Kohanim in the Beis HaMikdash as well. And they run away. We'll get back to them in a few minutes. Antiochus now, after he massacres the Jews in Yerushalayim, decides that he also has to start getting involved in the Beis HaMikdash itself. He wants to start playing around with what's going on in the leadership of the Beis HaMikdash, and he now changes the name of the Beis HaMikdash. Instead of being known as the Beis HaMikdash or the Beis Hashem, this is the place where we visit God, he now renames it to be Beis Elil Apolipis, that he now named it after himself. This is the place where we have the idol that has my image. This is my home. If I am the emperor, if I'm the leader, I should also have the leadership in Yerushalayim. And that was something that not only Antiochus himself tried to do, but the Gemara in the end of Maseches Sukkah, the last Gemara in Maseches Sukkah, tells, has anybody ever heard of this statement? Oy le Rasha v'oy le Shcheno? Oy le Rasha v'oy le Shcheno means if you have a bad neighbor, you're going to end up becoming a negative person as well. That is a line from the last Gemara in Maseches Sukkah. Why does it come up there? So the Gemara says a story there about a woman by the name of Miriam Bas Bilga. Miriam was from a family of Kohanim. She was from a righteous family. These Kohanim for generations had been serving in the Beis HaMikdash, and the Gemara says they each had a locker where they would keep their stuff. And Miriam's family had the same kind of arrangement. One fine day when all this Misyavnim were gaining steam and all of this background of Antiochus HaRasha was happening, Miriam was so frustrated, she was so angry about what was going on, that God was forsaking the Jewish people, and she goes ahead and kicks the Mizbeach. It said she took her shoes and she threw them at the Mizbeach, and she was cursing at the Mizbeach, and she cursed out God himself, on that occasion. And the Gemara says that that was all at the same time. All of this was going on. It just shows you the terrible frustration that the Jews had at the time. Here you have a woman from a very well-known family, and yet just everything spirals out of control and totally deteriorates. That's what was going on. The Misyavnim were helping out Antiochus to destroy the Beis HaMikdash as well. And that's really what was most unsettling about the story, is that people from within, our own people, were the ones who were facilitating all of this horrible destruction. Antiochus now realizes, I have a big kingdom that I need to lead. I just won the war to take over Mitzrayim, to take over Egypt. I have a lot that I need to take care of. So he puts a minister in place named Polipus HaRasha, and he asked him to be the one to come and look over Yerushalayim. He said, I can't pay attention to this, but I know that I want the Beis HaMikdash to be something that is no longer going to be frequented. I want that the Jews should have no part in this at all. And Polipus HaRasha, it's your job to make sure that nobody will continue to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. And as a result of that, Antiochus leaves a number of instructions. Number one, he says, every Jew living in this community needs to bow down to the idol that I have made of my own image. Number two, every Jew in this community needs to eat Bisar Chazir, needs to be willing to eat non-kosher food. If not, if you're not willing to do both of those things, then that Jew's life should be taken. That Jew should be killed, because these are the rules, these are the new, this is what the king expects of all of his subjects, and that's what I want. Number three, he said, no longer are the Jews allowed to keep Shabbos, no longer are they allowed to have Yamim Tovim, and no longer are they allowed to perform the mitzvah of Bris Mila. These were the rules that were set down by Antiochus HaRasha at that time, and he leaves it in the hands of Polipus HaRasha to carry out all of his edicts, all of his decrees. On top of that, Antiochus was uncomfortable about the fact that people were paying attention to a Beis HaMikdash when they should have had their focus on him. As we see, this was very much about himself. So he decided that he was going to ban the Jews from doing two very important activities in the Beis HaMikdash. One was that once a year the Jews used to come to Yerushalayim. The Gemara says that Misha lo ra'a simchas Beis HaShoeva lo ra'a simcha miyamav. It says that when they came once a year on Sukkot to come and celebrate in the Beis HaMikdash with the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, that was the most joyous, most excitable time of the year. And Antiochus decided, we're going to get rid of that. No more Simchas Beis HaShoeva. People shouldn't feel that the height of their enjoyment of the year is in the Beis HaMikdash. That's not where the focus should be. He wanted the focus to be on himself. That was number one. Number two, he banned the Jews from coming to bring Bikurim to Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash. And he no longer allowed the Jews to bring up their first fruits. As we know, once a year when the fruits start to grow, the farmers used to come from all around Eretz Yisrael and bring the fruits to Yerushalayim. He said, no longer are we going to allow this practice to continue. And he then goes ahead and sets up all kinds of barriers along the way. He sets up all kinds of soldiers who were meant to stop people from going any further. If they saw anyone with a basket, they had to stop them. So the Medrash says that there were some Jews who brought the baskets anyway, and had they get through the checkpoint, they told them, no, we're just going to squeeze the olives in the mill, and we're going to make wine, we're going to make juice, and we're going to make all kinds of things. And then once they got through, they went ahead and brought whatever it had to be to the Beis HaMikdash. But those were just a few Jews, but most of the Jews were scared off by all of these officers, and they were not able to penetrate all of those roadblocks along the way. Once again, all of this was just made to try and demoralize the Jewish people, that they should no longer feel that the focus of their lives was the Beis HaMikdash. So much so that the Medrash says, and this became a popular and famous Medrash, the Jews of that time, the ones who were giving into this ideology, the Misyavnim, were told that they wrote on all of their shops, on all of their homes, they had a sign that said, we are now a part of this new religion, we are now a part of this ideology. And it says that they wrote Al Keren Hashor, which is a very significant place to write something. If you think about what was going on back then, if a person wanted to get anywhere, the only mode of transportation was on your animal. If a person wanted to do work in the fields, which was most of what was done back then, the only way to do that was with your animals. And on the Keren Hashor, which was so visible to everybody, they wrote, Ein lanu chelek be'elokei Yisrael. The Jews wrote, the Medrash became famous, Ein lanu chelek be'elokei Yisrael. We don't have any part any longer in the Jewish religion. We don't have any relationship with God. That's what was happening. Complete destruction of the Jewish community, complete annihilation of the Jews in Yerushalayim, and everything completely disintegrated. At that time, when all of this was going on, there were Jews who were killed al Kiddush Hashem. Sure, many of us are familiar with the story of Chana v'Shiva Baneha. There was a woman, Chana, and her seven sons, who all were asked to bow down to this idol. None of them wanted to. It all just puts it into context that this is what was happening. It's all because of that edict of Antiochus HaRasha, and Chana didn't want to bow down. Elazar HaKohen didn't want to bow down. He didn't want to eat the non-kosher food. Yossi ben Yoezer, one of the Tanaim. Many great personalities died al Kiddush Hashem, which was just in addition to all else that was going on at that time. One final thing that he did was, he sends one of his officers by the name of Nicanor, and he says, I'd like you to clear out the Beis HaMikdash. Number one, I'd like you to go and offer a chazir. I'd like you to take a non-kosher animal, a pig, and offer it in the Beis HaMikdash on the Mizbeach, which was an act that everybody knew was extremely upsetting, not only to the Jewish community, but everybody knew that that's something that defiles the Beis HaMikdash, and that's one thing that he did. The second thing that he asked Nicanor to do was to clear out the Beis HaMikdash. As we know, in the Beis HaMikdash, they had all kinds of very beautiful kelim. So they had a menorah that was made out of miksha zahav. It means it was made out of one piece of gold that was chiseled out. It was a beautiful piece of art and very expensive. They had the shulchan, they had the mizbeach, they had all kinds of different items that were necessary for a functioning Beis HaMikdash. This Nicanor comes along, clears out the entire Beis HaMikdash, and sends all of the items from the Beis HaMikdash down to his master, down to Egypt, Macedonia. He sends down everything from the Beis HaMikdash, the Shulchan, the Menorah, one of the Mizbechos. Everything is sent down to Egypt, and now you walk into the Beis HaMikdash, there's nothing there. There's no Jews in Yerushalayim, most of them were killed. The last few Jews who are still alive now are hiding somewhere in the forest. Everybody else either became Misyavnim and moved down to Egypt to start this community in Alexandria, or the rest of the Jews that stayed behind who were Misyavnim just were going along with all of these plans. And basically the Jewish community was decimated. There was nothing left. No Beis HaMikdash, nothing left at all. All you have is just a hollow structure with nothing inside. No avodah going on. They put pigs on the Beis HaMikdash, on the Mizbeach. They had this idol in the Beis HaMikdash, and that's what was going on. The Gemara says in Avodah Zarah, Bo Pritzim V'Chilaluha. Our enemies came and basically defiled the entire Beis HaMikdash. There was nothing left. There was no sanctity left to the place that we held to be so sacred. When all of this was going on, as we said, one of the families that stuck to the faith was Matisyahu Ubanav. It was Matisyahu and his children who went out and were hiding and trying to continue on with their faith. His five sons were, anybody know? Yehuda. I only know it from my children's song. Right? Yehuda was the most prominent of them. He was not the oldest child, but Yehuda, Yochanan, Yonasan, Shimon, and Elazar. Those were the five children of Matisyahu Kohen Gadol. They are infuriated by this terrible condition that the Jewish people find themselves in, and they say, time for us to go out and fight back. Listen to how absurd that is. Time for us to go and fight back. Who are you fighting back against? And who are you? You're like a little guerrilla warfare. It's like, it's just nothing. This is not a war. This is nothing. You have a few people going every time they can find some Greek soldier and they can stab him to death. Okay, so they did, but that was it. What do you have already? And the Medrash says that this war went on for a little over 3 years, which was amazing. But I wouldn't even call it a war. What kind of war is that? You don't have two armies fighting against each other. You have one very strong and powerful army that basically runs the entire world. That's the most powerful empire in the world. Against a bunch of unorganized, a bunch of unarmed citizens who are coming to try and test the leadership. So this was going on. And although they had all these little skirmishes with the Yevanim at the time, it wasn't really getting anywhere. It wasn't picking up steam. Yehuda Maccabee stands up and he says, Mi chamocha be'elim Hashem, who's willing to join me? Mi la Hashem Eli, who wants to join the forces? Who are you talking to? There's no one there. You're going out with your five brothers to fight against, and you have nobody with you. And he slowly gets recruitments from different little communities of Jews who are hiding out in the woods, till he builds up some kind of little makeshift army. And at that point, although the Jews were tremendously outnumbered, Yehuda HaMaccabee is able to be instrumental in this unbelievable miracle of the Jewish people. Now go back to Al HaNisim and think about what it is that we say. Think about what it is that we say. Masarta giborim biyad chalashim. It's not even a comparison. It's like some crazy person in the United States wakes up one day, decides, I'm gonna bomb the whole world. I'm gonna destroy the whole world. You don't have the ability to do that. We'll shut you down before you have a chance to do so. Imagine the odds. It doesn't make any sense. Yehuda HaMaccabee, who is not trained as a fighter at all, who has five brothers with him and a couple of recruits from all the little forests where everyone was hiding out, Yehuda HaMaccabee decides to build up the courage and he says, "I'm going to topple the leadership of Antiochus." Is he crazy? But that's what he does. Masarta giborim biyad chalashim. This is not just that the underdog won. This is the army that didn't exist won against the most powerful empire in the world. And then it says, "V'rabim biyad me'atim, utmeim biyad tahorim." What does that mean? That's a reference to the misyavnim, the Jews, who were helping out with the fight against their own brothers. Matisyo and his children come out and they fought tmeim biyad tahorim. We saw the degeneration of the entire Jewish community. We saw how many Jews now have fallen into this horrible way of life. And they went out and fought against it. They were Lochei Melchemes Hashem. They decided to take it upon themselves. We are going to defend the glory of God. We are going to restore the glory of God to Yerushalayim. And they went and they killed their own brothers, the Misyavnim. That's what it means. Tmeim biyad tahorim, Urishayim biyad tzadikim. Those Jews, those Misyavnim who went and guided and colluded with the enemy all along and were helpful and instrumental in breaking down the leadership of the Beis HaMikdash and having all the Kalim stolen out and having everything be completely destroyed in Yerushalayim, now it was time for Rishayim Biyad Tzadikim. Now it was time for these five great people, courageous men, to stand up and take back the leadership. V'zeidim Biyad Oskei Sarasecha. And therefore says the Tefillah, Ulecha asisa shem gadol v'kadosh balam. Can you imagine? For those who are old enough to experience 1967, that was a mini. That wasn't even close to this miracle. But we all know, or if you didn't remember it, at least you heard about it. I wasn't born. But for those who knew about it, for those who knew what it was all about, I've watched many, many movies about the war in 1967, I'm very taken by it. But when you think about the odds and you learn about the incredible glory to the Jewish people at the time, I was told that a Jew anywhere in the world at that time felt so proud and people were afraid of the Jews at the time. Can you imagine? Ulecha asisa shem gadol v'kadosh balamach. Can you imagine? The Jews, can you imagine how much glory and pride they had that they just toppled the most powerful government in the world that had completely destroyed all of them? It's amazing. And when you read the Tefillah and you see it in the historical context of what actually happened in those days, you understand that this was an absolutely unbelievable miracle. An absolutely incredible miracle. Something that really made no sense at all. I think about it so often. The Medrash says that we as a Jewish community are se'achas ben shivim ze'evim. The way we are referred to is that the Jewish community is a small community. We are se'achas, we're one little sheep that's between 70 wolves. All of them just want to destroy us. Everybody around us wants to kill us. Obviously, we have friends along the way. We live in a democratic country, and we're very blessed to be living here. But there's always been anti-Semitism, and it will never stop. It will never end. We've spoken about this in the past, but that's the story of our people. 1,900 years wandering around the world, se'achas ben shivim ze'evim. And finally, in 1948, we're given the opportunity to come back into our own land. Just think about the story of that miracle. Just understand what it means and understand how powerful it is. In 1948, I looked it up yesterday. How many Jews were there in the land of Israel? Anybody know?
500,000.
About 600,000 Jews, something like that. One of the places I read said 650,000 Jews. Okay, it's a nice number of Jews, but how many Arabs were they surrounded by at the time? 50 million. 50 million Arabs surrounding the Jewish community of 650,000 people. Is this not the Hanukkah story just playing itself out again? Masarta giborim biyad chalashim. Are you crazy? 600,000 Jews, Holocaust survivors who didn't have an army, who didn't have an air force, who had absolutely nothing, come and they decide it's time for us to reclaim our land, it's time to reclaim our place. We need to have our own community in Israel where we belong. We need to conquer Yerushalayim. Imagine how ludicrous that is, how insane it is. You're starting up with 50 million Arabs who are living around you. And may I ask, how many of those 650,000 Jews that were now Holocaust survivors who had gotten there a little bit before, how many of them actually fought? I assume many of them were so scarred from the war, many of them weren't able to fight at all, many of them were older people. I don't know. I have no idea what the numbers were, but I would imagine not every single one of those people went out to fight. What do you have, 100,000 people went out? Maybe? Probably much less? I have no idea, but I would imagine it was far less than that. Going up and fighting against 50 million Arabs. Is this different than the story of the Hashmonaim? Of Matisyahu Ubanov? Five Jews who are willing to stand up courageously and say, this is our place, and we're fighting the fight of God, and it's our obligation to do whatever it takes to make sure that the pride of the Jewish people is restored. And we can have massacres, and we can have a Holocaust, and we can have all of the terrible things that we've experienced over the many millennia of Jewish history. But at some point, there are courageous Jews who stand up and say, enough is enough. And it's time for us to restore the glory of God and the Jewish people back to the world. It's what happened in the days of the Hashmonaim. It's what happened once again in 1948, 1967, and it happens every single day. We're living one long miracle. And for anyone who's blind enough not to be able to see it, just open your eyes and look around how improbable it is, how impossible it is. The Jewish survival in the state of Israel since 1948 has been nothing short of the greatest miracle. Se'achas ben shivim ze'evim, literally, we have millions and millions of Arabs who only want to kill us, who hate us more than they love their own children. They hate us more than they love their own children. They're willing to do anything to kill Jews, and yet, Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker. This is the Hanukkah story playing itself out again. Bayamim mahem bazman hazeh. That's exactly what we say in our davening. Bayamim mahem bazman hazeh. The same miracle that we experienced then. And the same way that Jews today don't even realize it. So many Jews live their lives just missing the whole story, not understanding what a miracle it is, unless you take a step back and actually internalize how incredibly powerful this miracle is that we live through and how blessed we are to be living in the generation that we do to experience all of this. You can miss the whole thing. I would imagine there were Jews in the days of Yehuda HaMaccabee who also missed the whole thing. They just thought this was a part of natural history. Sometimes empires rise and sometimes they fall, and sometimes leadership turns over to someone else, and that's just the way it is. We cannot allow ourselves just to be blind to the reality of the miraculous times that we live in. Bayamim ahem bazman hazeh. The Hanukkah story that we're going to celebrate in another 2 weeks is something that's as relevant today as it's ever been before, because it's just playing out once again. So we come back to our story of the Hashmonaim. And finally, after all these incredible, miraculous victories in battle that were so improbable that made absolutely no sense, so they come back to Yerushalayim. And the Jews, can you imagine the sense of excitement? They finally have a chance to come back to the Beis HaMikdash, but they have some very difficult obstacles. Problem number one, there's nothing in the Beis HaMikdash. There's no kelim. There's no menorah. There's no shulchan. Right? We don't read about this when we say the davening on Hanukkah, but it wasn't so simple. Come back to the Beis HaMikdash, and there's nothing. What do we do? So the Gemara says a whole discussion. We know from the Psukim and Chumash that these kelim need to be made from slabs of gold. Who had gold? They had nothing. They were living in forests. Who had anything? They were being oppressed. They were being pressured by the government to give everything they had. They were lucky enough to remain religious Jews. They certainly didn't have any extra gold to give to the Beis HaMikdash. Nobody had any money. And the Gemara says that they were negotiating. What are we going to do? We have to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. We have to now be able to light the menorah. But how are we going to do that? We don't have a menorah. And the Gemara says they came to the final conclusion that although it's not really the right way to do it, but under these circumstances, we're going to build a makeshift menorah. We're going to have a menorah shel eitz. We're going to make a menorah that's made out of wood. We'll try to coat it with some metal. It's not going to be so nice. It's not going to be gold. But look, what can we do? Under the circumstances, that's the best job we can do. And that's what they did. And it says it was a number of years until they had enough money to build one that was made of silver. And then it was another couple of years until they had enough money to build one that was made from gold. So when they came back to the Beis HaMikdash, it's not like all's well that ends well. It wasn't so simple. Beis HaMikdash was not able to run as smoothly as everyone expected it to. So finally they come up with this plan. We're going to build this menorah. Everybody's working on the menorah. Everyone's figuring out how to make it. That's what they decide to do. Then they're going to make a shulchan. They're going to make everything else that they need. However, they come into the Beis HaMikdash and they see that there's this mizbeach made out of stones that was still there right in the middle of the Beis HaMikdash. The golden mizbeach was taken away. Everything else was taken, but they have this mizbeach right in the middle. As we said before, bo pritzim v'chilaluha. Our enemies came and desecrated and defiled our mizbeach. As we said, they offered non-kosher animals on the mizbeach, and now the Jewish community is faced with a problem. What do we do with this mizbeach? What do we do with this mizbeach? How can we now offer sacrifices on a place that has been so terribly desecrated and defiled? So that's not an option. We can't use it as a mizbeach going forward. What do? We're going to take it out, just move it to someone's house, so he should use it as a dining room table. So we know something that's been used for the property of the Beis HaMikdash, you're not really allowed to use it for your own personal use. So that wouldn't be appropriate either. Well, what's the third option? Destroy it. How can you destroy a mizbeach? Who's willing to stand up in the Beis HaMikdash and destroy a mizbeach? This was one of the issues that the Jewish community was dealing with. What do we do now? We can't use it. We can't take it away. We can't destroy it. I don't remember how long it was, 10 years ago when they had the Gush Katif, the terrible story of Gush Katif. It was around 10 years ago. So I remember I went with my father the day before the whole Hitnatkut happened. And my father had gone, they asked him to give shiurim in many of the yeshivas, and they asked him to give chizuk. And we went to visit many of the people there. And I remember in some of the communities, these people were so convinced there was no way it was going to happen. They hadn't even packed anything. Everything was in the house, like as if there was nothing about to happen. They were completely convinced that a miracle would take place and that the government would take back its decision literally a day before it happened. And at that time, they weren't letting any other people into that community because they knew that all these Israelis were coming in to make it more difficult for the Chayalim to take them out. But somehow we got a clearance. I don't remember what it was. I assured them I'm not hiding in anyone's basement. It's okay. We'll come today. We'll leave today. It's fine. And that's what we did. And I was very taken by one rabbi of that community who came and discussed with my father the following. I remember he said, he wasn't really asking a question. He was just saying what's on his mind. He said, I believe this is going to happen. And I'm very pained by it. And I don't know what to do. However, he said, here's my biggest problem. I have a shul, I have a yeshiva that I worked my whole life to build. Am I going to leave it for the enemy to come next week and firebomb it and destroy it? Or whatever they're going to do in there? Open it up as something that a Beis Medrash or a yeshiva should not be used for? Shouldn't I go ahead and destroy my shul before I leave? Wouldn't that be more respectful for me to destroy the shuls and the yeshivas that I've built instead of having our enemy defile them? The Hanukkah story. That's the Hanukkah story. That was the problem. What do you do with a mizbeach that's been defiled? Do we as a Jewish community destroy it on our own in order to save it from being defiled even more profoundly? Or do we just leave it as it is and whatever happens, happens? And at the time they decided, it was a painful decision, but they made a decision to dismantle this Mizbeach in the Beis HaMikdash because they felt they had no other option. They took it apart. Can you imagine what kind of feeling that was? The Jews are now coming, trying to rededicate the Beis HaMikdash, trying to repopulate Yerushalayim, and now they go ahead with their hammers and they're chiseling away, smashing a Beis HaMikdash in the middle of everything. So while some Jews were going and building a menorah, and other Jews were building all the other kelim necessary, these Jews were sitting there in the Beis HaMikdash, breaking down a Mizbeach, because they felt they had no other option. It was not so simple. Life was not simple at all. And now, finally, they finished doing everything. And the war is won, and they have rededicated the Beis HaMikdash, they have built a menorah, they finally finished building a Mizbeach, and now they say, let's light the menorah. Now you understand and appreciate a little bit more what great miracle that actually was. They come and they have another obstacle. We have no oil. Now what kind of oil do you need for a Beis HaMikdash? You need Shemen Zayizach. What does Shemen Zayizach mean? Not just olive oil. The Gemara tells us it has to be the first drop out of an olive and nothing more than that, because that's the best, that's the most pristine oil you can get. Not only that, the Gemara tells us they used to go to a city, Tekoa. That's the city that had the most juicy olives. I'm not sure exactly what was so unique about them, but that was considered to be the most preferred place to get the olives for the olive oil. So the Jews are now saying, here we have everything ready to go. We've rededicated a Beis HaMikdash. We have all the kelim. All we want to do is light the menorah. But we don't have any oil. And the problem is, to get to Tekoa is a four-day travel from Yerushalayim. So 4 days there, 4 days back. We're going to have to wait 8 days now in order to light a menorah. And even when we get the olives, till you get enough oil squeezed out of those olives to have one drop from each one till you have one bottle of oil will take you forever. So what are we going to do? This was the obstacle. And there's infighting and everyone's trying to figure out how are we going to do this, what should we do? And one Kohen there is standing and he just sees out of the corner of his eye that there's one pach shemen. What is the likelihood of one pach shemen? What's the likelihood? When you think about it in this context, then you see every single valuable item in the Beis HaMikdash was stolen. Everything else was broken and destroyed. What's the likelihood of one pach shemen being remaining there somewhere hidden in the walls? What's the likelihood of that actually happening? A miracle. It was a nes nistar. People might not realize it, but that's what we speak about when we say about the pach shemen. It wasn't just the miracle over the fact that it lit and it burned for longer than it should have. It was the miracle in the fact that they found it in the first place and that it was intact. That was the first part of the miracle. What's the likelihood that they left anything behind that was usable for us when we came back to the Beis HaMikdash? This was the story of the Chashmonaim. This was the story of Matisyahu Ubanav. And this is why we celebrate on Hanukkah. Number one, we had this unbelievable military victory. Number two, we had this incredible experience of seeing the miracles continue to unfold once we came back to the Beis HaMikdash and we had an opportunity to rededicate it and we were faced with all of these obstacles. The Ribono Shel Olam showed us that he was willing to give us the oil. He was willing to leave one little remnant to remember that God is still here. For all those Jews who hung up on their front lawns and who wrote on their horns of their animals, Ein lanu chelek be'elokei Yisrael, the Jewish community who stuck to the faith now were assured that the Ribono Shel Olam loved them so much and he remembered them. And he gave them these incredible miracles that they should be able to remind themselves that he is an incredibly important force in their lives. What I find very interesting is that although we have two different miracles that happen on Hanukkah, one was this very unfathomable war that was won between Matisyahu Ubanav and the greatest empire of the generation, but we also had this miracle of the Pach Shemen, of finding the oil and then the oil burning longer. I find it interesting that in commemoration of those great miracles, we do not have military parades. We don't go outside and, you know, do all kinds of cannon salutes. What we do is we say Hallel on Hanukkah. We light candles on Hanukkah. Even though the military victory was an incredibly important part of that time period and of the whole story. And I think the reason why is because for anybody who thinks that the military victory was just a physical battle that was won, and they went out just because they were a bunch of zealots who loved to fight and who loved to shoot, that is not at all what the story was about. This was about a group of courageous Jews who felt there needs to be a glory of God that is restored to the Jewish community. There needs to be a glory of the Jewish people that needs to be restored. This wasn't about activism. This wasn't about just fighting. This was about a number of Jews who decided that we need to once again bring God back into this picture. We need once again to have a Beis HaMikdash. We need to be able to serve Him the way we want to serve Him. We need to have religious freedoms. And that's what this was about. And the greatest way to celebrate religious freedom, the greatest way to celebrate those miracles of having God back into our lives is Halal v'Hodah, is by saying Halal. It's not by going outside and having a military parade. It's not by celebrating our great might. It's by recognizing the fact that God is the one who made us win these wars. And it's by recognizing the fact that now that we've won the war, what is its significance to all of us today? Why is it that we are excited about the fact that the Hashmonaim were victorious in that battle? Why do we care that we have Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim once again? We care because it gives us the opportunity to once again experience God in our lives in a way that we never have before. And that is what was great about that generation, Bayam HaMahim. That's what's very special about our generation, Bizman HaZeh, today. That we can experience once again the presence of the Shekhinah coming more closely into our lives. We can experience a life of religious freedom, a life of allowing us to connect with the Ribono Shel Olam in the way that we are supposed to. And on Hallel, that we say on Hanukkah, that is our opportunity to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to rededicate our efforts to connect with Him once again, not only for the Nisim that He did for them, but for the ongoing miracle that we are experiencing today that is playing out by Yamim Ahim Uvazman Hazeh. So, Amir Tzushem,